The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to Open Lines on Sunday, the last day of February. It's February 28th, 2010. And for those of you that are counting, this is show number 1317. Great to be here. I'll run through a couple of announcements and open line rules, and off we go. Just a heads up, the open lines telephone is not yet connected. That is because I want to go through a couple of things before I open the lines up, on the assumption that you're actually starting to call more this year than in years past. So if you do call it, you'll get a busy signal. I will announce on air as soon as I free that line up to start taking your calls. The toll-free number for those of you who do want to call us is 1-866-687-7223. There are no call screeners. Let it ring until it can be answered. We'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. And again, it's shut down for the moment, and we'll bring it up as soon as we open the line in a few minutes. On email for the show, drspace@thespaceshow.com, dmlivings@yahoo.com, and thespaceshow@gmail.com. And chat is on the AOL family of IM, ICQ, and CompuServe. The screen name is all one word, Space Show Chat. And Space Show Chat is visible. Remember, I'm using Trillion Pro 3.1. You should see Space Show Chat. If you don't, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com, or just go ahead and ping it. One word, Space Show Chat. It shows it's perfectly working fine on my end here on Trillion, so I need your feedback if you are experiencing a problem with that. Please remember that we're trademarked and copyrighted. You do have permission to download shows, copy them, share them. Please don't do anything commercial, and don't change the text of any of the interviews. And we podcast with Gigadial.net and Andrew Grummet. We thank him for his service. The Gigadial subscription is on our website, and both of our newsletters, you'll find that RSS URL. So listen to him. We're in Podcast Alley. We're iTunes compatible, and we're in a host of other places here and abroad. And so, other announcements. Our website, thespaceshow.com. And on that, you'll find our comprehensive newsletter that gets posted either late Sunday or early Monday morning, California time. It has all of the details of the program, the guest bios, and a coming events section, and it is also where you will find announcements or program changes if we have to do any. So check it from time to time, okay? And then everything we do is archived, and you can listen to shows going back to 2001 right off of our website, or you can download these programs. And then we have a store. It says Space Show Gear. Check it out on our website. And then, of course, the Support the Space Show button. 501c3 is what we are, a nonprofit, with the OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And if you are a U.S. taxpayer and you make a contribution to One Giant Leap Foundation, you do get a tax donation. We could not do our program without your support. We absolutely need it to stay alive. And we thank you for your support, for those of you who have supported us and those of you who will be supporting us. I do send email thank yous to everybody making a contribution. If you have made a contribution and you have not gotten an email notice within a week or two, send me a note. It means that something happened. I didn't get the contribution notice, or something happened to the email that I sent you. So please keep me posted on that, okay? Remember, the Space Show is brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation, promoting cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, visit secureworldfoundation.org. And tomorrow, on the Monday show, Cinda Collins is the co-founder with her husband of Secure World Foundation, and Cinda is going to be our guest tomorrow. So if you ever wanted to know about space nonprofits, why do it, what the challenges are, what Secure World is really about, because they do fabulous programming, this is a show to listen in on and to talk to the guest, Cinda. Okay, remember we do Twitter, MySpace, and Facebook to promote the show, but I don't read the walls. I don't go looking at all these pictures that people send me. I simply don't have time. I'm a one-man show. I don't have time to hang out on all these different websites, but we use them to promote. If you need to communicate with me, please don't do it through Facebook. Just send a note to drspace@thespaceshow.com. I do my best to answer every single email. Even when you send 20 emails to me on the same damn subject, you'll probably get 19 or 20 replies. So if you've sent me an email, you don't have a reply within a week or 10 days, send it again. It got into the spam filter or somehow it got deleted or I overlooked it unintentionally. I answer every single email. So if you don't hear back from me, please, after a week or so, send your note again. Okay, hold the dates. Number one, trends in the new space industry, a series of conversations and networking by the 62 Mile Club and Robert Jacobson this coming week, Wednesday, March 3rd, 7 to 8:30 p.m., Marina Del Rey, California. That's just south of L.A. near the Los Angeles airport. More information, and you need to RSVP, use the email address info@62mileclub.com. And then Responsive Space. I'm headed there March 8th through the 11th at the Westin Hotel in Los Angeles. Their website, you can still register, responsivespace.org. And remember, I do a live show there Tuesday night. There won't be any telephone input because of the Westin Hotel facility, but email and chat will clearly be working, and our guests will be people attending that live show from the Responsive Space Conference, and anything and everything goes. I actually believe Robert Jacobson might be there, too, so we'll see. Contact Conference, March 26th through the 28th at NASA Ames. Get information about that at contact-conference.com or .org. Either one works. Space Access Society, April 8th through the 10th in Phoenix, Arizona. Make your plans. Get all the details at www.space-access.org. Hey, Space Access is going to be really hot this year because this is the hotbed for new space and commercial space. And given the president's space policy announcements on February 1st and all the eagerness on the amount of a lot of people to see the president's program replace the program of record, I expect Space Access to be the hot-button conference for the foreseeable future. If you're able to get to Phoenix or if you're in the Phoenix area, do not miss it. Again, space-access.org. Okay, going right on down the line, the National Space Symposium by the Space Foundation, Colorado Springs, Colorado, is April 12th through the 15th, and you can make your plans at spacefoundation.org. ISDC, May 27th through the 31st, check it in Chicago. Check it out at the NSS.org website. Click on ISDC link. But also the day before, May 26th, is the Space Investment Summit. All of these are at the Intercontinental Chicago Hotel at the O'Hare Airport in Chicago. The summit can be located by going to http://spaceinvestmentsummit.com. Okay, open line. So here's what we've got, and I'll open the line in a few minutes. Rules. There really are no rules. Any topic, everything is fair game. Other than I won't do partisan politics, but I will talk about the politics of space policy because that's pretty bipartisan. I think both sides suck. So, we can talk that. We don't use the space show to assassinate people's character. There's no name calling. There's no accusations, but ideas, technology, engineering, all of that is perfectly fair game to go after, okay? But again, no character assassinations are permitted. So I am going to open up the toll-free line, and that toll-free number, for those of you who would like to call, is 1-866-687-7223, and we're up and running with the toll-free line, and we have an email. We actually have a chat from Stephen in Edmonton, across the northern border of the United States in Canada. So he says, Trillian again is not showing up for Space Show Chat. What a bunch of crap that is. Okay, so I'm going to reboot Trillian, and let's hope that that works. So, Stephen, since you're listening, give me about 45 seconds, let it reboot, and let's see if you can... if you can see it that way. And again, if anybody else has any issues about not seeing the chat, please let me know. But it was working. Space Show Chat is the name. And let's see what happens as I reboot it. So a couple of things have happened that I want to talk about. So one of them is guest suggestions that all of you make. And I absolutely welcome the guest suggestions, but I need you to keep your suggestions in perspective. It may be a hot button topic or individual for you. It may not have any legs for the rest of the space show. It may be a person or a subject that I have no familiarity with, and that's fine. You don't have to, give me a guest suggestion that says, I know who it is and all of that. But keep it in perspective. I get between 30 and 50 guest suggestions a week. I answer every single one of them, even when you send me multiple emails about the guest and why the guest should be on. Okay? But keep it in perspective, and remember that it may be a priority program for you, but it might be pretty far down the list for what the space show is working on, who is in the pipeline, who is being sent information, invitations, and all of that. So I have a special file for all of your guest suggestions, and I work through them, during the year. And remember, I understand it could very well be your priority, your paramount priority. I'm appreciative of your suggestions, but it's not necessarily what I can put 100% of my focus on the moment I get your email. So I need you to be understanding of that process and the fact that I'm one person doing all of this. And so sometimes what is your priority, may not be as much of a priority to the show given what's already in the pipeline. Okay, Stephen says we're now online. Thank you. Okay, glad everyone that you can see Space Show Chat. I have no idea why rebooting makes a difference, but what the heck can I say? So, again, be patient. Your guest suggestions are welcome. We'll get to them during the year. Hopefully they come in at a time, where I absolutely have the time to make your guest suggestion a total priority, but that doesn't always happen. So just bear with me, okay? And we will get to them. So, again, let me put out the toll-free line. It is 1-866-687-7223. Well, most of what has been burning my email up and, the newsletters and the material that I'm reading relates around the issue of the new space policy for the United States that President Obama, his administration, Charlie Bolden have put forward. So I would really like to hear from you on this. I mean, I've been hearing from people in officialdom, people from JPL, Jim Muncy, who was on representing the Space Frontier Foundation, Jim Vetta and others that are, in officialdom, at least to some degree. I'd like to hear what all of you think. I would suggest calling in or letting me know what you think. And, got an email from Kelly. He says he can't, I don't understand what's going on. Kelly, in case you can listen to me, the live feeds on all my systems are working. I have bandwidth being sucked And there isn't any reason to reboot. I would suggest you reboot your system. I would not have bandwidth being drained were there a problem on either of my systems. So, again, if you finally got to the program, Kelly, reboot. Hopefully you can get onto it. And we'll hear from you back if that is the case. And, Kelly, call, I'd like to hear your thoughts on, well, I know your thoughts because you send me a lot of emails, but I'd like to hear you express your thoughts on the new space policy proposed by the administration. Again, 1-866-687-7223. That is the topic of most interest to most people right now. I wish I had a crystal ball. I'd love to know what's going to happen at the end of the year and what Congress is going to go for and all of that. So we just wait and see. Let's see. What else would you like to talk about today other than the space policy? I guess it's part of space policy, but I've been getting a lot of email on Falcon and on commercial space, but it hasn't really been trafficked as part of the proposals by the administration, just in terms of commercial space, more specifically, and questions about Falcon 9 and its timetable and things like that. So all of this is fine. I'm trying to respond to Kelly as I'm doing the show, so excuse me for that delay. My thoughts on the space policy. Well, I think there's a lot of good stuff in it. But I'm not convinced that most of what is promised, even specified, will ever materialize. And some of that has to do with my own prejudices toward the administration, but also for those of you who frequently listen to the show, it has a lot to do with our economy and, my concerns that much of the out years, meaning this budget is for 2011, so the out years would be after 2011, will likely not be funded because of the directions we're headed with our deficits and our economy. And by the way, this would indicate the program of record, too. For those of you that are frequent listeners to the show, you know that I have said that the program of record would never survive the successive administrations. So there's no surprise to me that this administration wants to abandon the program of record and do something entirely different. I never thought the program of record would work because it was never paid for. It was never funded. And the next administration coming in would want to put its own stamp of approval on this or that. So, but I think there's a lot of good in this. I'm opposed to a cold turkey transition to commercial space. So I think that while we do work with the commercial companies and transition to them, we should maintain the government launch capability, and I, for one, support keeping the shuttle flying for a lot of reasons, and maybe we'll get into those later in the program. As far as going to the moon, I would like to go back to the moon, but unless and until we have a cost-effective way of doing it, rather than $1 billion a launch, and until somebody can absolutely articulate the most compelling case in the world for us to be going there and doing this, then I say it's not a program we should undertake. Now, if somebody can come forth and say, someone from NASA, not from the audience, or someone from the government, and say it's an imperative we're back at the moon by such and such a date because of 1, 2, and 3, I would like to hear that. But that is not ever what I've heard. We do have a caller. Let me bring up the caller. Caller, are you still with us, please?
Yes.
And you are?
John.
How are you doing?
Pretty good.
What is it you would like to talk about?
Well, on the space policy issue, the thing I agree with what you're basically saying, that the full program record, meaning the entire concept of just going to the moon and like it was totally laid out, obviously that was going to not survive. I kind of agree with that because of the economics and politics. But what the administration is doing here seems to be just scrapping everything. We're going to shut down the shuttle. We're going to kill off the Ares and the Ares 1 and Orion, and not even proceed the rest of it. So what I'm saying is we ought to make a choice between either extending the shuttle and allowing the commercial space, like SpaceX and I guess Space Dev, the Dragon and the Dream Chaser, to be developed, or what these other projects, and get them actually demonstrated and flying before we shut down the shuttle, or else we ought to continue with Orion and the Ares 1 at least, not the whole constellation, but just those two elements of it.
Well, first of all, shuttle, of course, was canceled during the Bush years.
This is correct.
So it, as much as I would like to blame everything on the Obama administration.
Blame Obama, no.
like he likes to blame everything on Bush, we can't really do that. And of course,
blame both of them.
And of course, Bush never funded this damn program of record. And, he passed the buck to, I think it was, four consecutive presidential administrations and eight congressional administrations that would have to approve funding in order to realize the vision for space exploration to some level of completeness. And that, of course, is la-la land. Everybody knew that wasn't going to happen. But I think the gap is really a big issue because I think we will lose some sovereignty and foreign policy needed advantages by, you know, being subservient to the Russians to get us up there. So that bothers me. The shuttle is the only way to buy down and to avoid that gap or at least to close it by however many years we keep shuttle flying.
Right.
But when you talk to people that promote and support what the president's policy, let's take Jim Muncy, for example, who is a very carefully thought out, articulate, wise space guy, and they talk about not having goals and what this means and not putting target dates down and needing to do this and this and learn this and learn that all over again, and they are flying missions. It's not all work being done in the lab. At one level, it's very, very hard to counter or refute what they say, but on the other hand, if you know how people get inspired, and if you know how engineering and business projects get done, they don't get done if there aren't any time schedules or commitments or timelines that you have to work for. And sure, they might get delayed. We all know that. Or they might get slipped for a billion different reasons. But if they never exist in the first place and everything is kind of open-ended, it's really hard to have a way to move things forward. And you're right, this is not in this program. Now, they do say, in all fairness, that the details are not out yet and details are in the devil or whatever that is, and it will be forthcoming. And yes, maybe it will be forthcoming. I don't know what's in their heads. But you're right, none of this is in there, and it does give the view, whether it be an illusion or a real view, that everything is being scrapped for a bunch of vague promises.
And the thing I'm concerned about here is this. If we scrap everything that's real and has a political constituency in various districts, and a real, tangible, ongoing operation, we have a lot of neat research programs going on that are being funded. But the problem is the budget pressure mounts in the years ahead, and they're going to get worse, I think, to do something about the deficit. These intangible development programs can easily be scaled back, delayed, put off, and the whole thing gets shoved further and further into the future. Or if you actually have something tangible, let's say, just for arbitrary choice, stay with the Ares 1 and the Orion only, and forget the rest of Constellation, you then have most of the key players have a vested interest in keeping those programs on track, as an example. The alternative would be the shuttle, of course. Either one, but I'm not extremely, that strong of a preference. I could live with either choice. I guess the shuttle gives you more near-term capability, which would be the advantage there to keep a continuous presence.
Well, you can't get any argument from me.
Yeah. The thing is, I'm concerned with this. I think there are people, like you said, don't get any personal, I'm not attacking anybody. I think there are people that, I'll give you an example from the defense world. During the Bush administration, the defense sub-cabinet got populated with a lot of people who had backgrounds in the subcontractor electronics world. And they said, let's don't build any platforms, let's just upgrade the ones we have. I think right now the commercial space people seem to have gotten into the administration and sold this idea, you know what I mean, in a sense. But I think they haven't really thought out the political dynamics of what's going to happen if they kill off the existing NASA programs, you know, that they may not get the support in the years ahead that they need, and we end up with kind of nothing at any rate.
Well, let's talk about that, because I have a thought on what they perceive about killing off the conventional programs. Well, first of all, you're 100% right. The commercial space folks are in the new administration. Okay, there is no doubt about that. They're associated with the White House. They're clearly associated to a larger degree than ever before with NASA. And, of course, the verdict on that is out. One can only, hope that this works out for the best for space as well as for our government space policy. But they see the loss of jobs, for example, and they're willing to acknowledge that it is a human cost, and they feel really bad about that. They always make sure they say, "We feel really bad about that." I mean, that goes a long ways, right, when you're trying to pay your mortgage, or you're going under or being foreclosed on, or
right.
you're about to take a tractor and bulldoze your house because you're PO'd at the bank, or whatever it is. But they're really rich on the sympathetic and empathetic rhetoric. I mean, you know,
yeah.
they say all the right things.
They feel their pain, huh?
Yeah, I feel your pain, exactly. And but you got to go for the good of everything. And in the meantime, commercial space will create so many thousands of jobs that you will still have an opportunity to work in your specialty field in the commercial space field. And because so many thousands of jobs are going to be created, this is a plus-plus win-win for space as well as for the country. And that is really kind of how they see, you know, the picture. Now, will commercial space over a reasonable period of time create thousands and thousands of jobs? I'm really skeptical. But I obviously don't have the magic eight ball answer any more than you do. But I am skeptical that it will happen on any kind of time frame. And furthermore, these space people that are working there have a national security strategic component to their skill levels, their knowledge, their experience. And, you know, when we trash the space workforce in Florida and elsewhere after Apollo and Skylab, I mean, it was really hard to rebuild and bring up a new space force, you know, that could do things. And we lost a huge asset. So I am one of these who values our space workforce as a national security asset. And one hates to think that NASA or space is simply a jobs program because, you know, who wants to be involved in funding just a jobs program? I mean, that's a non-starter to begin
right.
with, but these people, most of them, are really, really an asset to the United States, and to see them, you know, blown away, without, you know, thinking of the action reaction, the consequences, as you talk about,
right.
is really, to me, not only is it mind boggling, it's irresponsible.
That's kind of a viewpoint I have, and I'm not sure exactly. I mean, I hear there's a lot of pushback in the congressional hearings on it. I mean, Nelson and a lot of other people, some are obviously more partisan than others, but, you know, so I'm not sure whether Congress is buying the whole concept or not at this point. You know, I mean, it has an certain appeal to the conservatives. What's ironic is we have the Obama administration, you know, which doing this, and yet it has the philosophy has more of an appeal to the sort of Newt Gingrich wing of the Republicans, or the Dana Rohrabacher, or the only one I can think of that really spoke positively of it, you know. And it's kind of strange, you know, of the congressional people I can recall, you know.
Well, I don't know how it'll fold out. I mean, Muncie probably had the best look ahead and said, you know, there'll probably be some compromises and some remnants of Constellation, you know, may survive. And, you know, but usually the presidents get the bulk of what they're trying to do with their budget policy. So let's assume that what might be reasonable from what we're hearing is NASA continues to work on a heavy lift. But maybe heavy lift is defined as 75 metric tons instead of 150 metric tons.
Yeah.
So, and in the meantime, there still is no Moon, Mars, time scheduling, you know, hard dates. And most of all of this, people are betting a whim and a hope that the administration is telling them the truth and is really going to do what is in the rhetoric. And, you know, if you want to believe that way, fine. I'm this old dude who sees government as nothing but a bunch of lies, regardless of who's in there, and I wouldn't trust any of them to make anything happen. So that's my prejudice. And
another thing I see is, okay, but I would think that in the contract negotiation process, that the new companies probably have a lot of advantages, like the SpaceX's and Space Dev, so forth, on winning the contracts for this commercial space, because they're going to be lower cost for sure. They don't have the bureaucracies your big Boeings and Lockheed Martins and so forth have, you know. And yet they win these contracts, and then they do their best. They're really good. I really like these companies, you know what I mean? But I think the problem is they may fail to perform initially. They eventually might get there if they're given enough time and, you know, allowed to overrun a little bit, right? But the problem is you end up with nothing, you know? That's the thing that concerns me.
Well, that may be true. I have another concern, and that is that if this is the direction that is ultimately decided by Congress and the government to go on, I hope that NASA is fair and open and legit and honest in how they rate and qualify and test systems for flying humans on it, and they don't come in with a bunch of petty, prejudicial, non-level playing field, you know, regs and rules designed to say, see, we told you they couldn't do it, now let us go back and build Constellation or whatever. There's got to be a level playing field here.
Well, that's true. I mean, it just seems to me that other thing is the commercial space already has the unmanned supply mission contracts already underway.
Right.
And yet this stuff is not flown yet. I mean, I just like to see them demonstrate their capability at that level before we scrap the tried and true, if you will. You know what I mean?
Listen, you don't get much of an argument from me.
This is the thing I'm a little concerned about too. Is at the level of the people in NASA, the space. I wonder if behind the scenes aren't people that aren't really pro space at the higher levels of the administration saying, "Well, let these people do this. They'll totally wreck everything, and when it's over with, it'll all go away, and we can just do unmanned stuff and satellites and monitor the Earth environment and things like that." You know what I mean? And
I've heard that before. I mean, I have no inside track to know whether there are people in power positions thinking that way, but I've heard that as an accusation of even the administration.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously I don't know. I hope it is not. I hope it's just a thought, and that there's nothing real to it. But I don't know.
Well, I don't think that would be at the level of the people that are actually speaking up from NASA. I'm talking about, the question is, when you see take the administration, almost every other field we can look at, defense contracting, get rid of contractors, bring it in house. That's been the theme throughout the administration. The only area that they're going the other way on is space, that I can see, and it's kind of the strangest area to go outsourcing, you know.
It's not over until, as they say, the fat lady sings or Congress sings at the end of the year. So
why don't I make this a chance to raise these issues? Because I think they're
real issues. I'll bet you we hear from other people during the show today who are going to be saying pretty much the same thing that you're saying.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you.
What city are you in, by the way?
Atlanta.
Okay. Thanks a lot. I appreciate the call in.
Okay.
Okay. Listeners, that frees up the toll-free line. 1-866-687-7223 while we're waiting for the next call. Stephen in Canada sent in a note, and I don't know very much about this, but maybe some of you out here know about it. He says, how about the new Bloom Energy fuel cell? It could help in closing the loop on power generation and the recycling of biomass on long-duration missions. And I've, of course, heard of the Bloom Power Cell. Pete Warden talked about it on this show the last time Pete was on, earlier in 2009. Of course, there aren't going to be any long-duration human spaceflight missions unless another nation does it anytime in the near to intermediate future, pending what our space policy and our economics look like. But the last time I checked on Bloom, they were pretty tight lipped. I did make some efforts to get their CEO on the space show. Never got a response back from the gentleman. I guess we could try again, but as I recall, they were pretty tight-lipped on what they were doing, and I seem to even think that their website was either a placeholder or very scanty in details, and mostly what I was looking at were tech blog and news journal articles about them. So if anybody out there has updates or knowledge about Bloom Energy, B-L-O-O-M, and their fuel cell work, plus what they do in terms of biomass and creating energy about it, I'd like to hear the update. So you can call the show or you can email or chat in. And clearly, if any of you know anybody involved with Bloom and you know, could get them to be a guest on the space show, they would certainly be welcome. While we're speaking about guests on the space show, the Solaris company in San Diego that is doing the space solar power project with Pacific Gas and Electric, I would like them to be a guest on the space show as well. And I sent an info email to their president based upon the info address on their website. Got no response. If anybody knows anybody with this company and could help arrange a space show program, I'd be really interested in talking to them and seeing what they have to say about their deal with PG&E. Now, of course, if they listen to back shows and they hear me trash PG&E as a rate-paying customer, which I am, and not being the most supportive on a closed-to-business case model for space solar power, they may say this is not a forum that they want to come in and talk in. And I understand that if that were their attitude. I don't know if they know about some of our previous comments or shows, but if they do want to come on, they will be absolutely treated gold-plated, great respect, and any hard questions they will ask will be asked in good faith to see how they answer them, like when Peter Sage was on with Space Energy when he did that show from Dubai. We asked him the hard questions, and he gave us his best take, and that would be the same format with Solaris. So if anyone out there can help on that, go for it. I think we have another caller on the line. Caller, are you there?
Yes, it's me.
And you are for the audience.
Kelly Stark.
And you're up in the Connecticut, right?
This year, yes.
This year, yes.
Think you'll ever the contract wins take me.
Think you'll ever get to Leo or beyond and call in this show or not in this lifetime?
I don't know. As far as I move around on contracts, if there's an engineering project building something up there, I'll probably get contracted.
God help us sending you up there as an astronaut. But there better be astronaut babes up there or you're not going to last very long, let me tell you.
Oh, right.
Okay, I know what you think about this program. You're doing jumping jacks and push-ups all day long and in grandeur and splendor that somebody's finally saving space, right?
Boy, what Kool-Aid are you drinking?
You mean that isn't what you think, Kelly?
No, I'm, like we said before, I'm amazed at the amount of the new space people who are listening to all of this stuff and thinking, oh, yeah, Bolden said, you know, we're going to have thousands of people a year in space. He's going to foster the, you know, the revolution has come. You know, we'll put Boeing up against the wall and shoot them and comrades unite. I find, you know, things like Garver admitted that, you know, as of starting last August, they were talking with the Air Force on maybe how they could maintain the solid fuel industrial infrastructure for military missiles, contracts and stuff. You know, if they've been working with them for 6 months about a post-Ares situation for that issue, how come they can't answer a straight question from Congress or the Senate over, well, what are we doing next after the space station?
Well, probably because they don't know, Kelly.
Yeah, but, you know, if they've been planning this for 6 months and they don't have more flesh on these bones, I get the feeling they don't want to have to answer any hard questions for a few months.
Well, of course, I can't tell you the answer to that. I don't know. But look how long it took the administration to make a decision on Afghanistan. So they don't make their decisions and policy announcements quickly. I mean, that seems to be the trend. They seem to think them out and spend their time deliberating.
Yeah, depending on the issue and how much of a hot button it is.
Well,
I mean, realistically, I don't think this is considered a high priority in White House.
No, and nobody I've had on, even the people supporting the Obama plan, think that, that space is any priority whatsoever. In fact, I asked Muncie, one of the questions was actually a listener asked him if they thought that the debate that would go on over the next couple of months in Congress would rise to the level of national health care. And, well, you know the answer to that. You know, it's a resounding no. You know, I don't even know if the majority of Americans know there's a space policy debate going on and a new space policy and a direction for NASA that has been proposed.
Well, about 2 years ago, I left the contract house and was, you know, saying goodbye to a one of the execs in that company. And they're, you know, a small aerospace company that make instrument clusters and, you know, basically the panels for airliners and military aircraft. And the exec there didn't know that the shuttle was being grounded. When he heard that was going to Orion, you know, he was just stunned. And as little impact as, I don't know how many people really knew we had a moon program going back.
Here's a question for you, because this caught me off guard, and obviously it caught other people off guard. We've kind of been hearing that shuttle retirement in Florida, specifically Florida, would affect about 8,000 people. You can say maybe 7,000, maybe 9,000, but in that range. And then suddenly toward the end of last week, they're starting to say, coming out of OMB and other sources, that shuttle retirement may can 25,000 people. So what the hell's going on here?
I'm thinking that the 7,000 or 8,000 was only the people in Florida that will be laid off. 25,000 is probably more the national numbers.
So why, one can say, why is the press and why are officialdom, including members of Congress, stunned all of a sudden that the number triples? I mean, wouldn't they know what was going to be impacted in the shuttle workforce in a retirement of the shuttle? Or do they only see Florida and nothing else?
Yeah, they haven't exactly been proactive on this whole deal. I mean, you did have a couple of administrators or senators and congressmen from particular districts like Florida who are raising some of these issues. But, yeah, I don't think they really anticipated how much the secondary is. Well, even if you take it directly, 7,000, 8,000 in Florida, there's what's called an economic multiplier effect. If you take one job out of a district, you know, those people don't go to get groceries, so the grocery store lays people off. They don't go to many restaurants, don't buy as much other stuff. So you have like a 20 to 40-fold factor of other jobs in a region that, you know, go away. So you could reasonably say that 25,000 number might be hundreds of thousands of people across the United States from all these little mom-and-pop companies that made parts for the shuttle, and, you know, that's the only thing still using parts that old anymore. So they go away. And even directly in Florida, if they lost 7,000 jobs directly around the Kennedy, man, you're going to see a hell of a lot of empty houses around the Cape.
Well, what is 25? I mean, if we lose 25,000 in shuttle retirement alone, I mean that's a huge technology hit in this recession.
You're looking at an awful lot of aerospace companies and professionals. And one of the things you have to remember is aerospace in the U.S. has taken tremendous hits over the last couple of decades. I mean, 90% of the big companies and 99% of the small companies have gone away. And of the remaining people in the field, they're getting old. You know, I go into offices and, you know, I'm in my lower 50s and I'm not unusually old. So if you suddenly have massive layoffs, those people aren't going to be able to come back in a year or two.
Well, they'll go to other professions and other jobs.
Yeah.
You know, they'll find other work.
Yeah.
How do you draw the line, Kelly, a jobs program for NASA, but at the same time wanting to keep this highly skilled national security asset workforce still involved, you know, in space and their directly related jobs? Nobody wants to think that NASA is just a jobs program, because that implies busy work and and projects that aren't worth a damn and all of that, just to be able to keep people employed. But on the other hand, national security and national asset, job and skill base is crucial to our country and our security and our economy. How do you balance a jobs program with the essential facts that we need these people?
Well, there's a couple of factors that could spawn other things in the aerospace business. For example, they canceled the F-22 program last spring with the understanding and the assurance from Gates that there was going to be nobody else able to build a craft that can compete even with our legacy 1970s era fighters for another decade or two. And now Russia just started flight testing on a craft that's beyond the F-22 in capability and will be fielded and for international sales in about 7 years. You'll probably see a lot of political interest in a few months in not shutting down the F-22 and maybe looking to accelerate the upgrade program. That'll keep people busy. They're looking to retire the current generation bombers, which, you know, I mean, a lot of them B-52s. They were first designed in the 50s. The last ones built were built in the 70s. They want to retire those and go to a newer generation. That program's online. There's been some funding looking for that. So other programs like that will come up. Also, I think one issue that hasn't been touched on, you know, just this week, India announced a 60% increase in their space budget, specifically so they can start manned spaceflight. Now, India is used to be the poster child of third world backwardness. To have them turn around and, you know, suddenly be flying people to space while NASA's, you know, sending its last manned spacecraft into museums, that could play badly in Washington.
Well, what do you say to the people who say, yeah, there are no space races going on?
NASA has never gotten a lot of public interest for what it does, but it has gotten interest for the national prestige. I mean, we've been the preeminent space people. It's, to just shut that down and say, well, you know, we can use the Russian craft for a few years, and after that, if the commercials come up with something, then we can do that. And the fact that they're being so nebulous about what their plans are, it doesn't feel like they really have any interest in it. So it's easy to sell that, you know, they're just shutting it down. Again, as you say, there'd really be a push to try and suggest something valuable that the NASA would be doing. You know, going to Moon or Mars in a few decades, you know, that's not really going to excite anybody.
Well, what about learning all of these skills and flight testing all of these demos for hardware and new, you know, instruments and new technologies and methods for doing things? Are you totally just dismissing that, which is part of the administration's proposal?
That could keep some people employed, but they're not really new technologies. So you have the political danger of, you know, yeah, but you flew this 40 years ago. You know, it's like when I was talking to Muncie on Wednesday, and he says, oh, yeah, we'll develop lightweight solar cells and ion, and that'll give a better thrust-to-weight ion craft. It's like, yeah, but we flew solar-powered ion craft, you know, a decade or two ago. So, you know, making a showpiece out of an upgrade to something you didn't really seem to do much with in the first place, you know, it, you could keep some people going, but it really does seem like busy work, just sending them back to the lab to tinker.
The interesting thing, and again, I, you know, this came up on the Muncie show, but it's also been up on the other shows where the new policy has come up, most of what everybody is excited about is not really spelled out in what has been released so far. It's innuendo, it's rhetoric, it's vagues, it's a lot of wish list thinking, it's a lot of reading into what we're being told. And it is, as I like to say all the time, wish list thinking. We've been given everything we believe in, therefore we believe in it, and therefore it's real. But if you actually look at what's being written and what's being said, rather than what is being clarified, there are huge gaps. So,
yeah,
you know,
well,
do you go by what's the written word so far? I understand it's going to evolve and change. Or do you go by what Lori and Charlie and other people are saying it all contains and it all means?
Yeah, that's, you know, I've been getting a lot of arguments on that in various space boards. And what amazes me is, you know, there's always been a joke that NASA, there's two NASAs. There's the PowerPoint NASA, and there is the metals NASA. You know, NASA generates a lot of books, a lot of presentations, paintings, which talk glowingly about huge long-range plans. We're going to develop fleets of RLVs, space stations, bases on the moon and Mars, you know, the nice Robert McCall paintings of astronauts in front of, you know, a moon base that looks like something out of 2001. And then there's the metal NASA, where they just talk about maintaining the existing stuff. Bolden and Garver are being much less detailed than even those old PowerPoint presentations. They kind of allude about a grand future in the distance. You know, Garver talking about, yeah, by the mid-century, you know, we'll have people landing on Mars and Moon.
Well,
and
I don't think they know the details yet. I really don't. I think they're telling the absolute truth when they say, you know, details to follow.
But the thing is, if they have gone this far, and there is no details from anybody, and they're just kind of hand-waving grand stories in the distance, it really should be given much less credibility by the public than the PowerPoint presentations and slideshows of decades past. But instead, the space advocate groups, I guess because it's pushing their buttons, you know, talking about contracting stuff to people and, you know, huge markets of thousands of people going to space, you know, they're just jumping for this, and they're seeing it as a hard, fast guarantee, even though that's nothing. There is no details. There is no statement. There is nothing anyone could arm twist out of Bolden and by, you know, senators and congressmen could get out of them indicating they have any intention to do anything of scale, that not even anything that had been discussed that they could outline. You know, in a press conference in front of the space advocates, they will talk grandly of, you know, in a couple of decades this could lead to, et cetera. But point blank now, when they say, what are you planning to do now? What is the next thing? What kind of things you're talking about? It's just gone. There's nothing. It's just smoke and mirrors.
Kelly, hold on a minute. John, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Kelly, surprise. This is John who wants to enter in and ask you some questions.
Okay.
Dr. Juris, go ahead.
Actually, I have questions for both of you, and that is, you're really talking around some of the very, very fundamental issues here in terms of our society. So given our budget and the realities of our current political life, how would the two of you restructure our civilian and our military space programs, and would you change the mix between military and civilian, or would you push a human military space program, or what would you do given everything that's going on today to further humanity going into space?
Kelly, go ahead.
Okay. Well, given the realities of the budget, there is no reality of the budget. They're talking about tens of trillions of dollars we couldn't possibly pay. So, I mean, even Constellation was, you know, crumbs compared to that. As to what I'd like to have seen done is probably more like what the commercials hoped they're seeing. You know, if NASA had come out and say, okay, you know, we need to have a national launch infrastructure, and it needs to be far more than this, we're just going to contract it. You know, if you guys come up with the next generation shuttle or, you know, whatever, we won't look over your shoulder, we won't make you quadruple your costs, which is the norm, with NASA government procurement regs. We'll just buy services to orbit. And, you know, we'll work with the DOD, and they've got satellites and stuff. You know, so some major commercial project for a ship that could bring man and material to orbit, geosync, you know, lunar orbit, whatever. And that would be something that could be really done affordably. I mean, if you didn't have the government oversight, you just contracted for services and set up a big contract, kind of like what Lockheed was trying to do in the 90s and Boeing and everybody else, you could get that out in the field for $10-20 billion.
But how easy is it for a bunch of politicians to let something like that go when they see a pot of $10 or $20 billion sitting out there?
Well, right now they're kind of backed into a corner where they're going to have to walk away from Constellation and Shuttle. So, you know, and they know there's nothing at the end for them for new space, so this would be better for them. There would probably be a lot of political pressure to try and do it as a traditional government procurement, and that would stretch out the time at least 10-15 years probably, and that would quadruple a budget, which would mean, I mean, it would be small compared to Ares Orion. It's like, you know, the shuttle orbiter is a lot cheaper than the Orion capsule, even add in the Ares 1 booster or Ares 2, would be, you know, much lower cost. You can get the safety up. You know, a lot of things you could never hope to do, either with any of the current or near future commercials, or, you know, certainly anything like Ares Orion or current shuttle. So that might sell. And you might get the military on board. For example, they've just put their mini shuttle, the X-37, it's in Florida now. It's being integrated in with an Atlas, and they're going to fly it. It's an automated small shuttle, you know, winged, reusable, with a, I think it's a 4-foot diameter, 7-foot cargo bay. So they might be interested in getting on board with a more expansive craft. And, you know, you could point that as saving everybody money and that kind of thing. It, with all of it, I know I'm being really vague because you've got a lot of contradictory political arguments. I mean, one, saving money makes some sense, but it costs you political capital to do it. Senators and congressmen really want to see money spent in their district. But on the other hand, this has become so unpopular. Even districts that are going to benefit financially from Obama's plan, like Wolf of Virginia, Orbital Sciences, could be getting some money out of this. He was adamantly hostile to it. He wanted to see more detail. He wanted to see more expansive programs. So it's real hard to figure out the political currents right now. I would love if they had come out and said, we're going to do contract for service for all delivery of personnel and cargo to orbit, you know, any orbit on Earth, any orbit around the moon, with some highly reusable, can fly a couple times a week craft. You know, something that's a progression of the DCX tests back in the 90s and the shuttle and all the stuff that the commercials have been, you know, offering for decades and can't get anybody to buy in. Whether there's a political wind that'll support that, I don't really know. Well, I mean, on the other hand, you know, when they're talking about open bids, maybe United Launch Alliance will rebid flying shuttles, but flying them in a commercial frame, because if they didn't have to do all the paperwork and overhead that, you know, the SpaceX and something is getting a waiver on, they could save a hell of a lot of money on shuttle flights.
But the thing that bothers me about the scenarios you raise now is that, number one, the Air Force was burned by the shuttle back when they were going to cooperate and use the shuttle for launching a lot of their larger vehicles. And, of course, after the Challenger loss, they backpedaled very fast on that one. And then, secondly, if access to the space station is cut off for any reason, the space station is toast. And so is that $100 billion or whatever it has been that's been expended on the space station. So it, doesn't the government collectively have a real responsibility to maintain that access? And if you say, well, you're just going to contract it out to unproven launch vehicles, and by that I mean vehicles that have not flown in the configuration proposed and have not demonstrated a capability of hauling something to the space station and hauling something back down, aren't you really putting the station in danger and therefore endangering our past investment?
They've already signed up for that, which is amazing. I mean, from my point of view, I probably should have said I would have preferred also they bid to have two or three parallel supporters,
right,
for this grand thing.
Instead of sole sourcers.
Right, rather than sole sourcing it. So that you got two or three people flying these craft, you eat all the overhead, provide them Kennedy, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
As to your point about station, yeah, I think one of the things that has been pointed out by Congress is, I mean, as of next year when the shuttles are all going out to museums, the only way we'll be able to get, or anybody will be able to get to the station, is in the Soyuz. And the Soyuz,
right,
hasn't exactly been a trouble-free bird.
I mean,
they nearly lost a couple of people last year. Yeah, maybe in 5 years or something, you know, you'll have SpaceX and maybe Dream Chaser and some of the others. I know Lockheed Martin and Boeing had both been working on man-carried capabilities. But, yeah, it's iffy. You can't point to a vehicle and say, yeah, they have done this before. I mean, with Boeing and Lockheed, I mean, they've been supporting manned space flight for generations.
Yeah,
so
guys, in all fairness, though, Constellation Ares 1 is a new vehicle that is having its problems, its delays. You know, it's certainly cost overruns, and it has not flown in its configuration either.
True, and even NASA graded the SpaceX as higher in quality and engineering effectiveness than they graded their own Ares Orion ship. Considerably higher grading, as a matter of fact. But, you know, the reality is NASA hasn't been doing a great job. They don't have the expertise in system engineering program management that they had back in the 60s. When I was involved in Space Station Freedom in the 90s, and NASA so bungled it, they quietly turned the whole thing over to Boeing. But politically, they're still seen by the public as the gold standard in how you fly space. So if you do turn around, if you're a congressman and say, oh, yeah, we don't need NASA, we can do the commercials, you know, you're going to have to put the commercials under a microscope so they absolutely can't fail or screw up, you know, which becomes a whole too big to fail, and then their numbers go through the roof. And as you say, just a practical issue, what if they don't make it? You know, I mean, Musk, you know, 40% of his craft haven't flown right or at all. You know, he's the guy out ahead. I think if they do deliver to COTS, it's probably not going to be the Alt.Space space people who get these contracts. You know, I think Lockheed and Boeing are probably going to be the ones in the lead just because they've got the expertise. They can be cost competitive under similar rules. A lot of people were surprised when Bigelow did a bid and Lockheed Martin bid for crew carry to Bigelow stations came in quite competitive with SpaceX's. You know, the same rules, they can do as well.
Well, could there be another issue in play? And that is that if NASA goes ahead and does this and screws up, basically that's a political issue and they have political cover that a private company would not have. If a government agency screws up, it's sort of like, oops, business as usual, and go on with things. A few people get replaced and so on. But if a private company screws up really big time, unless they're big enough to be like GM and get bailed out, they really have a lot of problems to face.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you saw that in the investigations after the loss of Columbia or Challenger. I mean,
right.
Major execs who just flat said, yeah, we knew this was going to happen. You know, we just didn't want to, you know, take the political hit by making noise. You never would have seen Boeing handle it. I mean, look at the kind of flack you've had with the Toyota executive dragged before Congress to apologize because somebody's carpet on their Toyota got stuck the pedal.
Accelerated.
Well, more than one somebody.
Yeah, but even in that, it was kind of nebulous. It's like the one lady who came on and cheerfully said she called her husband to say goodbye. She thought she was going to die because you know, her Lexus was out of control. Well, they sold that Lexus to other people who've never had a problem with it.
Well, I like the story better where the lady has to wear false teeth from her dead sister, but that's another subject.
Yeah, well.
Hey, Kelly, I got to clear the line to let some other people get in because they're pounding me on email saying, clear the line, clear the line.
Okay.
But, John, stay on because I want to answer your question.
Okay.
Because... hold on. You ask about DOD and NASA and all of that, and I think if there's a couple of things that first of all, DOD of late has proven that they're probably a lot more efficient and effective than NASA, and one can look at a lot of the reasons behind that. But I think most people would have a lot more confidence in DOD running some kind of a human space program, even though everybody will balk at military in space, and say no to it. But I would think that there'd be more bang for the buck if DOD were somehow involved in some part of the human spaceflight program. On top of that, DOD is not under the discretionary budget. So as hard times continue and deficits continue and things are squeezed and most people think that national security has a legitimate role to play in our government, as do other entitlements that are not part of the discretionary budget, but think that discretionary things should give way to human needs, you know, like prescription drugs or fill the donut hole or healthcare, you know, take your pick. There's a whole bunch of them. It might be easier to squeeze out any life with NASA programs, and might be easier to see DOD programs at least hold their own or have some gains in them without necessarily having to worry about changing public perception on the value of space, which clearly needs to happen, and all of the kinds of things that would make a discretionary program more mandatory in the general public's eyes and the members of Congress' eyes who have to answer to constituents, assuming that they care and will answer to constituents. And in this particular Congress, that, of course, is a big question and a big if. I think the verdict is really out on that. So I would, in a perfect world, favor more of a switch with some of these programs to dual purpose with DOD, only because of the reasons I've said. But look, we both know that's not going to happen. And we both know that Congress isn't probably going to go down that road. And we both know that if somehow the deficits are not reined in and the spending is not controlled, that discretionary programs are not going to receive the kind of care and funding that they have in the past. And for those people who think space will be so wildly successful that they will commercially take us out through investment in wealth of the recession and of the deficits, I think if you had the most wildly successful commercial space industry, you would not see it making a dent on the U.S. economy in the big picture. We're a half of 1% of the budget, and of the discretionary budget, I think we figured out the other day that, we're 3% of the discretionary budget?
Something like
that. I mean, even in your wildest fantasy dreams of success with commercial space development and infrastructure, you probably can't create the number of jobs and the amount of wealth to make a dent in the economy and $15 trillion of deficits on just out of space alone. And we have raised the debt ceiling 4 or 5 times in the past year. And who's to say by the time some space program won't start to pay off, let's say when COTS starts to have hardware to fly and test, for example, who's to say the deficits won't be $20 trillion at the rate we're going?
Well, that brings up another interesting point, and that is timelines. Even if somehow space technology and exploration could be made to be incredibly wildly profitable, returning 100-to-1 or whatever on the national investment, there's a timeline involved, and most people would tend to think of space development and economics to be a longer-term investment rather than the sort of thing that gives you a nice bottom-line return for the next quarter.
I don't even think they see it as a bottom-line return. I just think it's probably, to those that even have it on their horizon or their awareness, it's just kind of a non-entity. It's there.
I mean, it's just wishful thinking.
Yeah, the only ones who are really attentive to this and know anything about it are the space community, the workforce, the advocates, the enthusiasts, the blogosphere, the people that we all talk with and associate with. But we're a tiny, tiny part of the population of America. And if you were to add up space cadets all over the world, what is the world, 6.5 billion people or something? We're probably even more minuscule as part of the global audience than we are anything else. And even though space is playing a role, like in tsunami warnings and being able to see what's happening in Chile and know how to do aid and things for Haiti and stuff like that, the space component is totally lost in the discussion. It's just not there with most people, and not valued.
Well,
hold on just a minute. We have another call, and if this is who I think it is, this is applicable to you. So hang on a minute. Caller, are you there, please? Caller, are you there? Did you hang up? Hello, hello, hello. Going once, twice, and 3 times. Okay, I guess the caller got off, so I guess it's not applicable to you.
Okay.
All right. So that'll free your line, too. And the toll-free line, everybody, is available, and that is 1-866-472-5787. 877-6877-2223. If you get stuck on hold, don't hang up. Stay on hold. We'll bring you up as quickly as possible. And we haven't taken a break, and I need to get a drink, so we're going to take a two-minute break, and we'll be back with this Open Lines program.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, listeners. You're listening to Open Lines on the Space Show, and we have Jose.
Hi.
Hang on just a minute, Jose. We have Jose on the line from Barcelona, Spain. Welcome to the program, Jose.
Thank you, David.
Go ahead.
I'm glad to be here. I'm a long-time listener of the show from overseas, from Europe, and I'd like to provide a little bit to connect with the previous discussion about U.S. space policy, a little bit how I see things, or some of my fellow Europeans tend to see. I think there's a bit of a problem of attention span, I think. Congress and elections are a four-year deal, and companies have quarterly profits to show. These are very difficult to put together with a long-range space program. I think what we are seeing has to do with that. It's not so easy to get it right, because there are things in the structure of how the decision-making process is done that make it difficult to be sustainable. I think that we have a lot of questions about all this commercial talk and ITAR. I used to work for a little bit on the Ariane 5, which is arguably the leader or one of the commercial leaders in uninhabited space transportation. And we would never be able to pull it off and have such a launcher with such success rate if we had something like ITAR. And Virgin is even having lots of troubles to sell tickets to people outside some countries. ITAR is going to, either you change that or it's going to be very tough to make money on a global commercial world.
Well, I do know that this administration has really set ITAR reform as a policy, and again, their rhetoric and what they say about it, and the efforts that they seem to be putting in place to modify ITAR all seem to be pretty good. So, you know, maybe there is a chance that ITAR will get successfully moderated, but who knows what it will look like. But the administration's plan calls for lots and lots of international cooperation and synergy and working together, not just selling tickets to this person or that person. So for all of this to happen, ITAR has to be modified if we are going to involve non-U.S. participants or partners or however you want to say it. One can only hope ITAR gets modified. I don't know that they'll be successful or not in doing that, but they're making all the right noises, let's put it that way.
Okay, I didn't know about that. And then there's another, I mean, it was touched upon before. It has to do with the workforce and the aging and so on. I'm a little familiar with the Chinese program, and the average age is very young. It's something like 35 or so in their engineers doing their human space program. The average age here in Europe is a bit higher, but it's nothing like what you guys have over there. And when I was as a graduate student at MIT, I always got the impression that smart kids went to do bioscience, materials, or bioengineering, artificial intelligence, all these things that could get them work that was secure and more highly respected and remunerated. And in the department I was, aeronautics and astronautics, it was clearly the U.S. students that were the smartest, they were not in my department. They were in other departments. And I think that's just a data point, but it's as far as I know, in Europe, airspace still attracts pretty smart people, and in China as well, and in India as well. I don't see that's the case anymore in the U.S.
You don't get an argument from what I've heard. The smartest people... well, first of all, JPL has no recruiting problems from what they tell me, and that they do really get outstanding people. But other than that, I hear like Cisco Systems, Apple, you know, computers, some of the high-tech companies, you know, in the computer and technology and the mobile world and that, you know, seem to have a much easier time of attracting people. They make more money. They see their products come to fruition much faster, and Congress doesn't kill their products. So, I mean, it's a no-brainer, right?
Mm-hmm. And, this has an effect on whatever, I mean, Congress can decide whatever they decide, or Obama propose whatever they propose, but there's not the fuel to, I mean, there's not the human capital to do it. Or if there's problems with that, it's going to be more difficult. I think the solution, if there's going to be one, and I wish there was, to jumpstart it again in the U.S., would have to be more comprehensive than just tackling a budget, which, of course, it's important, but it's just a budget.
Well said. You actually have a space tourism project, a space tourism balloon project, right?
That is right. That's something that goes way back to the year 2000 when I met Peter Diamandis in Chile, actually. And my best wishes go to everybody in Chile, and I hope that everything goes as well as and as smooth as possible in such a tragedy. But I met Peter Diamandis. You probably, of course, you all know him. He's the founder of the X Prize Foundation. We met in Chile in the summer station program of the International Space University. We were working on a report. I was a student at the time here, on a report about space tourism. So I tried to understand from him, because he already had a very clear idea of how it would develop. And it was amazing to see that things happened much like he expected. But I tried to understand why would a person spend so much on a flight, and I came to the conclusion that it's basically the view. If you ask somebody how much would they pay to fly to space, whatever that means, in a spacecraft with no windows, it wouldn't be much, right?
One would think, of course, acceleration and the other aspects of it get ratings too, and a zero-G experience.
I think so. They get, but there's alternatives for that that are less costly. But the view with your own eyes of the planet, you can go to IMAX, and a lot of people do, but it's not with your own eyes. And you can get accelerations and centrifuge. I've done myself a few parabolic flights, and it's a lot of fun, and you actually spend quite a while floating if you do one of the long ones in Bordeaux, in the Airbus 300. It's a lot of room. And you get about 10 minutes or so floating in little bursts. But, I mean, it's in my company, we know, at least we know why we're doing it. I mean, the mission is we want to elevate our planetary consciousness. What do we mean by that? Make people aware that they're on a planet, visually aware. So that's the whole point for us. There's a value proposition on elevating our planetary consciousness. And that's what I thought that was, I mean, to me, it's not really space tourism. What I'm involved in is trying to get people to see with their own eyes that they're on a planet. And from that discussion with Peter, he really wanted the 100-kilometer line because that's what he had written on the X Prize contest. But I thought, well, do we really need to go so high to make people aware that they are on a planet? And if you run the numbers and look at the Rayleigh scattering and the geometry, or even if you go to Google Earth now that didn't exist in 2000, and you go up a little bit, about 30 kilometers high, it's pretty good.
So what do you propose with your balloon project?
Yeah, what we propose is flying people on a pressurized pod to 36 kilometers in a custom flight. Every flight would be customized for the people flying, and then for the clients, and staying up there for a whole 2 hours. Of course, that's a record altitude, but current technology and our understanding of winds and materials make it possible. And so you would stay for a whole 2 hours up there, seeing the Earth shining blue below, on the curved horizon and the darkest sky. You may be able to see a few stars if you're the right time of day and you take you look at the right side of the pod, and then you come back the way that most space faring powers have done it. That's with some sort of parachute, right? And that's it. It's a simple thing. It's not unlike what it was done up to 61, both in the Soviet side and the Americans. They were flying people up on the stratosphere, and it's a step that has been taken by government programs in the past, and that we think that fits also makes sense in the new privatization, if you will, of space activities. It's something that can be done cost effectively, and also which something that is important now with zero emissions.
You know, when you sent me your idea, I told you I was going to send it to a couple people to give me their opinion, and one was Charles Pooley, and the other one was Dr. Jurist. And Dr. Jurist is on the line, so I'm going to bring John in on this call, because you're talking about basically a helium balloon that goes about halfway to space, correct?
Well, it's twice as high as the Concorde and one-third as high as what's often considered space. Yeah.
Okay. John, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
So you did look at his material, as did I. And of course, the first thing everybody looked at, Jose, was the cost of helium. So since you're hoping to do this for a lot lower cost than flying on, say, an X-Core or a Virgin vehicle, we're not sure that you're going to accomplish that with the cost of helium, which is probably even more costly in Europe than it is in the United States.
Well, what it comes
well,
down
it's,
to...
it's right...
The
yeah,
last
it's
time I
very cost-
hold on, one at a time.
Oh, yeah, sure, I'll listen to the question.
Go ahead, John.
Well, the last time I had looked at it, enough helium to lift a 10,000-pound vehicle, which you would call it a 5,000-kilogram vehicle, is going to be on the order of $12,000. So unless you can recover the helium somehow to, for reuse, which I'm really skeptical of, a person being able to do with a high-altitude balloon, your base cost is going to be controlled somewhat by the fixed cost of helium alone. And helium costs are going to be going up and have been trending up relatively rapidly over the last couple of years. The second thing is that although government agencies have put people up in the 30 to 35 kilometer range, they my understanding is that those gondolas have basically held one person for those very high altitude balloon flights. And that's, again, because of the weight. If you take your 10, 12,000-pound or 5,000-kilogram vehicle, and that includes balloon payload, whatever structures you're carrying along, life support system, and all the rest of it, you're talking about a balloon that at altitude is going to be something like 400-plus feet in diameter. And launching balloons of that size is very, very sensitive to wind and other constraints, and it's not an easy process, despite its having been done for a number of years. And there's a high failure rate associated with it. The last attempt for anybody to beat Joe Kittinger's record for a high-altitude parachute jump was foiled because they lost the balloon. And that sort of thing happens relatively frequently. A lot of the people that... I've worked with in academic environments, send payloads up to what you might call near space or close space, is basically high altitude of the same levels that you can attain with balloons, and they're constantly frustrated by their dependence on balloons. So I think that's a problem. Now, having said all of that, I'm a strong believer in evolution, and I think if people have ideas they want to try out commercially, they should try them out.
Those are actually, very, very accurate points and very relevant. We've estimated, of course, our weights are slightly below what you estimated, and it's about 70,000 euros per flight in helium. And that's not recovered, which is an important cost, but it's still manageable, and you can make a profit. We wouldn't be if we sold tickets on the vehicle, it's called Bloom, just like Bloom Energy, but instead of an M, it's an N, Bloom. If we sold tickets at a much lower price, we would have a demand that would be huge. And so we are pricing in the region of suborbital flight.
So are you saying a flight would be $100,000, or what do you think it would be?
€110,000, which is like $150,000 or so, about that.
And how many people ride the balloon at a time?
It's two pilots and four passengers. And that's right, the helium is not a renewable source. It's going to run out someday. And we're never gonna impact that, even if in our wildest dreams, when you run the numbers. But the price will go up, and it would be amazing to move to other mixtures of gases that are safe. But we start with helium. And about the fact that it's been done. I mean, the balloon that we plan to use, it's flown almost on a routine basis by the French Space Agency. It's true they have trouble taking off, but it's also true that there's been no investment almost for the last 20 or 30 years in improving those techniques. And we plan to get investment so that we iterate the process, and we're not just happy with the way the balloons are launched now. Of course, we'll be sensitive to the weather and winds, but rockets are also. And that's, I mean, I don't see that those things as showstoppers, especially when you compare to other products that are rocket based that also are failure prone. I mean, failure modes of a balloon launch are quite benign compared to those of even a hybrid rocket.
Where do you launch the balloon from?
We'll be launching from the place that has the lowest ground level winds in the particular region of the world where we'll be operating. We'll probably start in Spain. We've also analyzed Morocco near Marrakesh, which is quite good for this. And, I mean, it's a combination of factors. It's the low wind near the ground. It's not getting too much into congested airspace, of course, while you're going up and while you're coming down. While you are at the top, there's no problem. And also, there's a question of shear in the tropopause. There's a layer of the atmosphere with sometimes shear winds, and it gets cold. And you want to get into the cold brittleness of the material of the balloon. But that's something that's been well understood for many years, and you take that into account. And we would like to have mobile operations. We don't really need a spaceport to launch from. I mean, it's just a sort of an inflatable dome that you can put in different parts of the world. Also, if customers decide that they say they want to see their own state in the U.S. or they want to see the whole country, you can see those from most countries. Of course, not something like Russia, but you can see Spain, you can see Italy, you can see your island in Japan or something like that.
Well, you know, for about $12,000 to $15,000, you can take a MiG-29 ride to 95,000 feet. And see much, much more. So, you know, we're talking about maybe 10 MiG flights for the price of one balloon flight and, you know, more than twice the height and more than twice the view. So why not just take a MiG flight and you get the acceleration and the rocket blasting off your tail, actually the jet motor and all of that. So and the G-force.
It's let me touch into that. Well, I don't believe that we go twice as high on the MiG. We go 36 kilometers higher, between 30 and 36, and that's just about the maximum that the MiG gets. It doesn't go to 70 or anything like that, and it just stays for one instant up. It goes up, that's a problem, and it comes back down. And the whole idea is being up there and for long enough so that you can be one with what you're seeing. You can reflect on your life, on your position on the world, on what it means to be part of a planet. Those things take time. You cannot do that in 7 minutes. You cannot do that in one instant. It takes time. And also, we hope that we will get our health requirements much much simpler than other vehicles. And of course, some people will want to do both things, you could have elderly people that can fly on balloons, but they probably cannot stand high G's because they may have a hip implant or something. Also, children are not allowed to fly on high G vehicles, but we don't have any very high G's. The worst is like when you're coming back on the parachute, but it's still quite manageable. It's nothing like a 100 kilometer reentry.
Well, what you have is a classic situation of how you perceive the potential market out there. And here the factors that are affecting the market are the various trade-offs, many of which are intangible. Between an hang time, the significance of the view against the significance of some zero G time or the acceleration or whatever. And a potential customer is going to be factoring a lot of those kinds of intangibles in terms of the experience, and then you have to trade that off against the development of your vehicle, its life support system, making sure the system is reliable enough for commercial use, and all the rest of that, plus the pros and cons of David's example of a high-speed MIG flight against and the mechanics of dealing with a high-speed MIG flight against the mechanics of launching and recovering a payload with a balloon. So, to me, that's one of those things where if somebody wants to pursue it, they're certainly welcome to, and the marketplace will prove them either correct or it'll prove them incorrect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's something commercial. I mean, we would like to incorporate, we'll be incorporating scientific flights, scientific payloads on all our flights. For future clients, it's important that they know that the flight has zero emissions or zero impact, environmental impact at all. But not only just zero, but a positive one, because since the craft will have different experiments, atmospheric and not just atmospheric on the craft. They know that they're paying these 110,000 euros not just to enjoy the view, but also to help care for the planet they're enjoying. That's something unique as well. You cannot really claim on some of the offerings.
Those are all factors that enter into it, and I guess time will tell as to whether you've assessed the overall situation correctly or not.
I didn't hear that well.
Well, I'm just saying that I expect that time will tell whether you've correctly assessed the situation in terms of the market and some of the technical issues correctly or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's basically we'll be it's something that for 3,000 kilogram payloads, the French space agency knows how to do on an almost routine basis with zero investment. So if we get the investment we're looking for, it's in the order of 15 million euros, I just don't see why it wouldn't work. And I've met a lot of people that actually get turned off when I tell them that when I'm offering them space tourism. It's hard to believe from us, space cadets, that we kind of like space, but for a lot of people, when you say, especially women, you say space tourism, they say, oh, it's not for me, but then I show them the pictures from our uninhabited test flights, and they see the beauty of the planet from 30 kilometers or so, and they say, yeah, I want to see that on my lifetime. Is that space tourism? I didn't know. But I really want to see this, and I want to take a picture of myself and my husband and my kids and have that as a backdrop. Also, by flying very slowly like balloons do, you can, it's much easier to make big windows. Like, big windows are tough when you're flying at Mach 3 or Mach 5, but when you're flying very slowly, it's doable. So when you go up there and you get your picture with your background, you really have a background that's seeable. If you go and take your picture of yourself with a window behind on a suborbital craft, you either see your face you have to put your head on the side, but it doesn't look as good.
You have a question from Rita, and John is off the phone. Rita says, how much distance, and Rita's in Los Angeles, and she is actually a space tourist market person, wants to fly, and go on to space tourism. What is the distance the balloon covers during the 2 hours?
Well, the whole flight is actually between 4 and 5 hours, because there's the ascent and the descent. It's 2 hours on the top, 2 hours up there. And you cover, it depends on the winds, but you cover something like 300 kilometers or so, which,
So you're drifting 300 kilometers with whatever the prevailing winds are.
Yeah, the interesting thing of the 21st century, that wasn't the case when this was done the last time in 1961, is that we know with amazing certainty the winds. So even if we don't control the trajectory, and we cannot say, I want to fly from Los Angeles to Vegas or something like that, and you can know that if you take off from LA, you know exactly where you're going to land. I mean, almost exactly. And the small error, and that's something that we've already tested with our own inhabited flights, and the small error can be corrected if you use a guided parafoil. That's something that the military is now quite capable of doing. There's some demonstrations of 18 tons being landed on precision landed with parafoils. And our suppliers for this are quite confident that in our time frame they'll have a system. It's a little bit like the crew return vehicle, but you have to land something like half the weight, or even less than the crew return vehicle.
Rita brings up another point, but also it was a point I was going to bring up. There are many people who have made serious efforts, and they're extremely skilled balloon pilots like Forbes and Dick Rutan and others that have tried to, you know, cross the oceans, you know, use a hot air balloon to go around the world. And these are at much lower altitudes, and they crash and burn. And recently the guy was going to jump from his balloon at 100,000+ feet in Canada, and a storm came up and ripped the balloon to shreds, and they found it 20 miles away. And he had to go get another balloon and build another balloon up for $100,000+. So, you know, and you're going considerably higher than what the hot air balloon goes, and really subject to, you know, what's in the atmosphere, except you've got a lot of people sitting in there rather than just the one, you know, hot air balloon pilot trying to set a world record. So aren't you putting people more at risk than flying a rocket that has gone through some kind of certification program with AST and a lot of flight testing?
Yeah, we'll do with our EASA, European equivalent to FAA certification, and it will be as stringent as for any other normal commercial vehicle. Otherwise, we wouldn't be allowed to operate. I'd like to mention that those flights were endurance flights, which are actually tougher to crack than really high altitude and relatively short time flights. And during long endurance flights, like crossing the Atlantic or doing the round the world trip, it's much much tougher than flying really really high. I mean, a bunch of MIT kids recently flew a digital camera for $150 or so and took amazing pictures. That's something that a lot of people do. Of course, it gives no indication of what it is to bring a human being and do it safely. But the thing is, you wouldn't be able to fly around the world for $150 any camera. It's going really high up. It's a question of how much helium you put and how big is your balloon. And those balloons exist. They're commercial. They haven't been human rated. But that if you put enough redundancy on your safety systems, it's something doable. And I mean, rockets they really need a lot of test firing to instill a controlled explosion. I mean,
when do you plan to start your flights, or if people want to get more information from you and want to be, you know, one of your customers, how do they do it?
Our website is www.inbloon.com. That's INBLOON.com. And we are taking reservations already. We'll be flying. It's hard to tell. It depends on the. I'm an engineer. I'm not a marketing person, so I can only tell you what I think is true. Sometime between 2013 and 2015, the escrow deposits that we're taking now will be flights from, and we're not touching that money, will be flights between 2013 and 2015. It will depend mostly on how the certification process goes, because we will have to certify it as two type certificate. I mean, two types flying apparatus. And that's going to take time, and it will be the first time something like this is ever being certified. So that's going to take, I don't know, anywhere from 6 months in a very optimistic scenario to 2 years. But that's why we have the 2013 and 2015 range of dates.
Rita in L.A. is on chat with me for this and wants to know what the speed of the balloon is. So let's talk about the ascent speed. How long does it take to get to 25 miles? And then what is the lateral speed once it's up there?
The speed is it's something like it depends if the day is cold or hot, but it's something like 15 meters per second or something like that. It starts quite fast and then it goes slower at the very top. It goes up much slower when it's up. And the horizontal speed is basically the wind speed at height. Which depends on your locale, depends where you're flying, but it's something like 10 meters per second or something like that.
And, okay.
That's our order of magnitude. The interesting thing is that the winds up there are extremely predictable. Not so much the winds and the troposphere, so near the ground. Near the ground is where all the noise is. But once you get up, it's pretty constant, and you're like you grab a like you grab a streamline or jet stream and then follow it. And yeah.
Okay. All right. So. We know how to contact you, and that'll be in the archive write-off. And I'll free the line for other callers, okay?
Thank you. Just my email is spacetourism@gmail.com. If you want, if any caller wants, to, sorry, any listener wants to send me an email, you can contact me.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you, Jose. I appreciate it. Bye-bye. And listeners, that actually frees up the toll-free line, which is 1-866-687-7223, and I have an email message from Jack in Virginia, and I hope Kelly and John are still listening, because one of you made the comment about Virginia being the first place likely for commercial cargo going to the space station. So Jack's comment is, which do you believe will be the first to place commercial cargo at the space station, Orbital Science from Virginia or SpaceX from Florida? And I think one of you said Virginia, so that would mean Orbital Science. But what do I believe? I think SpaceX is ahead of Orbital Science, but I don't have a lot of details on that. So were I a betting guy, I would bet on SpaceX as probably doing this first. However, if EELV is going to do it, and we are talking about Atlas V or Delta IV Heavy, those rockets already have exceptional track records carrying cargo and high-valued assets, in meaning very, very expensive and sensitive and essential military information gathering and spy satellites. So if we opened up EELV for cargo to go to station, both Atlas and Delta could probably do that pretty quickly, probably much quicker than Orbital getting its act together, and the same for SpaceX. But if we're only talking about Orbital and SpaceX, SpaceX is it. So, Kelly, if you're still listening, send us in an email and tell us what you think. And, John, if you're still on, tell me what you think is going to be, a faster way to get to space station. So there you have it, balloons for space tourism, and a lot on space policy, although we're no closer to knowing what our space policy is going to be or should be. Lots of, real, I ain't got another call, but lots of real concern on policy either way going on right now. It'll be interesting to see how this debate unfolds during the year. caller, you're on. Who is this?
This is Charles.
Hi, Charles. Welcome. You missed the balloon guy.
No, I did not miss. I've been listening to your show from the start.
Well, Charles, everyone, is the other person I sent his technical information to for due diligence evaluation,
yeah,
along with Dr. Juris.
Yeah, I only gave a partial initial thing, and I'm going to follow it up more stuff. I just had several things fall into my lap rather suddenly. Anyway, let me get right to the point here. This whole discussion about space and so on, I think, is a little bit like thoughts about aviation in the late 19th century. That is, it was end result or wish or dream driven with very little engineering. And it wasn't until the very early 20th century that engineering put shape and substance to aviation, and, well, we know the rest. Space is right now that way. If we set aside this entire bloated bureaucratic NASA business, which is hopelessly overpriced and expensive, if we set that aside and go to various non-governmental-backed space plans, right now they, too, are end-result-driven or wish-driven. In other words, we talk about being in space rather than how do we get there. And the engineering to build a pathway to space hasn't yet really gotten started. And I think it has to take the form of generations of very small, unmanned exploration systems, and then only later graduate in size to manned flight. And simply put off thoughts of manned flight for the time being. And then this whole space tourism business is an attempt to leapfrog that necessary homework that has to be done up front. And I don't think it's going to work. I don't think any space tourism system is going to work, but I'll let them try.
So you're not high on the balloon idea?
I don't think it'll work economically and practically, no. As you have been saying and so on, that balloons are far too iffy. They're far too fragile. They are torn easily by sheer winds and all that stuff. Rockets actually can push their way through air. Rather, you know, they kind of ignore the air and just bulldoze their way through it. But even then, backing up to the whole general idea of selling experiences in space, we're not ready for that, and it's not going to work. There won't be enough people to shell out the kind of money to sustain a business. Not even one, I don't think. We shall see.
Well, I clearly don't know. I mean, there's a lot of people, you know, betting the farm on it, obviously, right?
I don't know either, but here has been my opinion that I've been, you know, making plain for years. I think what we have to do is work on building a technological and cultural infrastructure that can build our way up to such things rather than simply dream of an end result and jump right there. I mean, in the 70s, we were talking about cities in space, you know, with L5 and all that.
Right.
With no way to get there. None. No way to get there. And we'll never get there until we build a way to get there. And building a way to get there is like that proverbial journey of 1,000 miles that starts with the first step, not the 100,000th step.
Charles, if you were the czar of all things space policy, and they said give us the czar's idea of the space 2011 budget for NASA, what would you propose?
I would convert NASA to back to what NACA was, a publicly funded agency to generate technology available to the taxpayer, like what NACA did in the early days of subsonic aviation. We have all this instant, marvelous data from which we can very quickly build an airplane that will fly right away. NASA can do that. NASA can also fund exploration flights. Fund it, not design and run them. Yes.
So that's more extreme even than the administration's policy.
Yeah, correct. Any paring back of the what I think is folly is moving in the right direction, but of course nowhere near far enough. I think NASA has to be reconfigured. I think that was due not long after the Apollo program was done, reconfiguring rather than preserving it under inertia and jobs programs and political pull. And
so, how do you get momentum for your idea?
My idea? Well, you know what my idea is, and I'm working on it. And it ignores NASA.
I know you want it, but I'm saying how do you get momentum for it out in the marketplace? I mean, an idea such as yours is not even being considered as part of the debate.
That is one of my frustrations. Too few people have even heard of this. But I think it's the way to go, and I think it can be started with a fairly small number of people. Look at where aviation began. It began with the efforts of a handful of people at the end of the 19th and beginning of 20th century. Handful of people.
Well, it's if you were betting, what would you bet the outcome will be when Congress sends the budget back to the president?
We'll have a slightly modified but highly recognizable NASA. Meaning that the conditions that have existed for the last several decades will still be present, you know, and it's just the outer coating of paint made look slightly different, but the underlying structure is the same.
Kelly sent you an email.
Okay.
Which I forwarded to you, but
okay.
He says, no, Charles, we've had the technology for decades. We don't have markets. It's not an engineering limitation.
Well, okay, and that's like arguing to the Wright brothers, give up on the airplane, we don't have a market for it, and we didn't back then. He's missing the point altogether, and so do most people who say there has to be an instant market, and I don't see it, but if you want an instant market that could be done early on with, you know, the micro-launcher system I've been working on, would be, say, space burial and sending souvenirs and so on into space for fee. You can actually generate cash flow revenue with that enough to support a small business.
Well, there are space burials with Celestis right now.
No, yeah. Check out their entire history and the number, 85 in their entire history. That's one every few months. You have to have your own launch system so you can scale up by a factor of 1,000 over what Celestis does. You have to do it 1,000 times faster than Celestis. And you do it with your own launch system.
Yeah, and they don't want to have a launch system. They want to buy rides on other rockets.
They don't want to be in business. But that's another story.
Yeah.
Again, they want to sell end result without having the means to get there. It's like with GLXP, the Google Lunar X Prize.
Uh-huh.
What struck me when I first saw the forum of the first generation of entrants that were jumping in on it, they were all talking about the rover. Nothing about the means to get it there. Again, people are skipping something. There's work to be done. There is infrastructure and technology, a working system that has to be built that does not now exist. The current NASA industry complex is so expensive that it's basically unworkable and inapplicable to starting a space age. An exploration of space. I think it has to be done commercially. It has to be done from launch means upward. And virtually nobody's doing it.
Let's see. John has a comment for you. I can't believe we're up on 2 hours. Why isn't Celestis working on getting their own launch system? Well, I know the answer to that, but
I don't know those people at all. I just assume they don't think in those terms. That's all I can figure.
Charlie Schaefer, who is the head guru at Celestis and Space, I'm forgetting the name of the other company that they operate under.
Space Services
Limited or Incorporated, has been a pioneer in the launch industry, and he knows the launch industry backwards and forwards, and he was part of Conestoga.
Yes.
He's the one who walked that through 18 different departments to get permits to it. I mean, Charlie goes back way, way back on launch systems.
The original space services in 1982.
Yeah, and he says, you know, very adamantly, he said it on the show many times because he's been a guest on my show many, many times,
right,
that the action is not in the launch companies. It's really hard. It's very expensive. It's unknown, uncertain. markets and complexities, and he doesn't want to have anything to do with it. He says, let the others work it out and fight it and go through it, give it to Elon, give it to other people, and he would much rather buy rides on any existing vehicle that has already gone through the testing stage and is operational.
You will never do business that way. You will never. Look at the CubeSats. How many CubeSats have gone up? Only a few, because they don't have launch means.
Well, I mean, that's a political and other problem, but I understand where he's coming from about not wanting to be in the launch industry.
There aren't enough people offering launch means. In fact, there are practically none, and they are priced with NASA-type cost structures, outrageously expensive. What has to be developed is low-cost, simpler launch means which do not yet exist but can. Laws of physics do allow it.
Yeah, and he doesn't want to be involved in that.
That's fine. He doesn't have to be. I'm not asking him to.
Yeah, he wants to be a service company.
Okay. What it'll be is a launch company that does develop a launch system might sell launch services to those who don't want to bother developing their own launch system and will pay whatever the freight is.
Absolutely, and that's what
money.
Yeah, and that's what his business plan is around. Plus the plus that's also what the orbital space tourism Excalibur is talking about doing. They want to buy rides for their capsule on existing rockets that are launched from various places around the world.
And I really, I think that market is right now saturated with the few Soyuz launches that have been done. I don't see that as being able to be more than what you see with the occasional Soyuz flights. A few people a year max.
Okay, I'm going to take one more question,
sure.
And then we're going to wind the show down because we're past the two-hour point. But Kelly said in comments back to you, Charles, people didn't know how to make aircraft in 1903, but we know how to make low-cost operational launch systems.
I disagree. We do not yet know. It's not been done yet. I'm working on it, and that's it.
Well, you'll get into a shouting match with Kelly and others on that.
Whatever. That's cool. I can argue back. And there's my argument. And, you know, when I manage to get the shop facilities going, I will actually start the hardware and prove the point. But until then, I guess I just have to make assertions until I can start making the hardware.
Rita says, Celestis is using a facilitator. If I want to buy a car, I don't get involved in the production of the car. That's not my forte. Charlie is correct.
Bad analogy, because car companies already exist. Launch system companies basically do not exist.
Okay.
So it's a bad analogy.
It's a bad analogy.
Yeah.
Charles, thanks for calling in.
Sure enough. I don't mind being a heretic.
No, you get off on it. Yeah.
No, I'm trying to make my case and then do it. And that's what I've been working on.
Are you staying in California or are you moving?
I'm probably going to have to move, and you know why. Sinking ship. This rat needs to get off.
Are you going to stay long enough to vote for a different governor in the state? Or
it
are you
won't
gonna...
make any difference if I do or not. I think this ship is... this is like the Titanic post-impact.
We're taking on water fast out here.
Yeah, it's rearranging deck chairs. Twice before, California has basically disassembled itself and reassembled itself. It may have to do this a third time, you know, with the Constitutional Convention and the whole schmear. In other words, do the technical equivalent to a bankruptcy or whatever you can manage, disassemble the state and reassemble it from scratch. But I don't think that's politically possible nowadays. Too many special interests.
Okay, and I got an email from Jose in Barcelona with the balloon launch thing. And, Jose, I will put out that email address in the archive write-up of the show, spacetourism@gmail.com. But people, you can also contact him through the website he put out, inbloom.com.
I'll continue with the material you sent me and some other material also. But
okay.
Some new things are happening in my end, and when it happens, you'll hear about it.
Charles, thanks for calling in.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Bye.
And let's see. Don't go anywhere. Jack, Kelly answered the question about who is going to be first, Orbital or SpaceX, and he says, I think both are starting test flights this year, but I think Orbital is scheduled to carry cargo to the station first, but it's a toss-up between SpaceX and Orbital. So there you have three views on it, Jack, and hopefully that will work. So we're going to wind down open lines for today. We're a little over 2 hours and only one break. So I'm assuming there are no other comments. Rita is still commenting on what Charles said. So this is her reply. This is the same thing Virgin Galactic is doing. This is, again, about being in the launch service or not. Is Charles saying that they will not be profitable? Virgin Galactic analogy. So Charles doesn't believe that space tourism will work. So that is the broad brush coming from Charles. But on the other hand, Virgin is controlling its transportation to and from the market, you know, to and from space. So they are building their own launch and operating systems and working to make it cost effective. So I don't think it's the same thing as what he's accusing or saying, not accusing, but saying about Celestis not having any transportation and needing to buy a ride from somebody else. Virgin is only using their own hardware and building it and designing it from the get-go. But overall, Charles is not optimistic that space tourism will be all that profitable, if at all. So, listeners, that's it for today's Open Line program. Thank you all for listening and participating. And we're back this week with programs on Monday, Tuesday, Thursday. The Thursday program with Eric Seedhouse will archive Monday of next week when I'm driving to Los Angeles for the Responsive Space Conference. There will be no program this Friday. I'm taking the day off. And then on Sunday is a space show classroom program on due diligence, finance, marketing, and business management. And the due diligence is both on the engineering side of things as well as on the business side of things. And then the following week, Monday replays the Eric Seedhouse show about his book, The New Space Race, China and the U.S., And then Tuesday is a live show from Responsive Space that we do every year. And then Friday will be taped interviews that I do while I am at Responsive Space during the week. So thank you all for listening. I look forward to hearing all of you on the line with Cinda Collins tomorrow about Secure World Foundation. And thanks again for being part of the Space Show.